What I'd like to do this week is to give you just a little bit of an overview of a number of areas. My particular interest is in astronomy and astrophysics, not in astrology. There is no such verifiable and justifiable topic. So right off the bat, whenever you talk to an astronomer, whenever the term astrology comes up, you start seeing the hair curl in the back of their heads. And, so we're going to talk about astronomy in here, and I'll probably mention some of the problems with the idea of astrology along the way, but that's one of the things we're going to cover. Within the area of astronomy, it is one of the most rapidly growing fields of science right now. There are a number of areas that are exploding. Astronomy is one of those. And the reason for that is because of the ability to observe the sky much more carefully than we ever could before. Most of you, I'm sure, by now have heard about the Hubble Space Telescope and its foibles. Well, it's up and it's operating, and it is the best operating telescope in the world right now, even though it's not as good as we had hoped. And so I'll talk about that a little bit too this week. Telescopes are one major reason, and computers are the other. Most of what we know about the universe around us comes from those two things: telescopes and being able to calculate what goes on. Mark earlier today talked about physicists and their need for equations. I'll try to keep that to a very minimum. There are going to be two that I'll just absolutely have to put up on the board, and some of you have probably heard of them, and I'll just describe what they mean because they come up so often. Well, that's one of the things we're going to cover, is most of the areas of astronomy. I want to start today by talking about the history of astronomy a little bit. It's really the oldest of the sciences, and as a result of that, has a long developmental history which is well defined, including what is known as the Copernican Revolution, where really the modern understanding of science began. So I want to sort of walk you through that. This morning, Mark also mentioned this term paradigm a couple of times in passing, which is a theory, sort of the standard theory of the day. Well, a paradigm is something that is more than just a theory. It's really a way of looking at the universe around us, trying to understand it. It really becomes a part of us, in a sense. The way we look at the world and look at the universe is based upon this so-called paradigm, this picture of how the world works. And I suspect that before we're done with this week, many of you are going to have your paradigms shaken just a little bit. The universe is a very odd place. We're going to talk about things like black holes this week. It's almost mandatory requirement whenever I speak to a group like this is to talk about some of these things called black holes, and we'll also talk about the Big Bang a little bit as well. And so we're going to touch on some kind of exotic topics. Tomorrow, just sort of to ease you into this a little bit, I also want to talk some about the physics in nature itself. That involves a lot of different everyday sorts of experiences. For instance, why do birds fly, or how can they fly? Why is the sky blue and sunsets red? And what is music? That's an aspect of sound. I want to talk about that a little bit as well, and where music, our scales and so on come from a little bit, and discuss that in some detail. So we're going to talk about a wide variety of things this week. One of the things I also want to do is to basically keep this as relaxed and as full of questions as possible. If there are things you've ever been curious about, fire away and use me as target practice or something, and see what we can do in terms of trying to understand the world around us. Because that's really what we want to do. What Mark started this morning, what I'm doing this afternoon, I think you're going to find in many ways are going to complement each other quite a bit in terms of how we're going to try to understand the world around us, both here on Earth and out in space. What I've given you is pretty much a summary of what I just said. It lists a series of topics. including the history of astronomy and a little bit of something called archaeoastronomy, which is somewhat of an interest of mine. That is astronomy in non-Western cultures, such as what Stonehenge was built for, the Mayan temples, the Skeedy Pond Indians in the American Southwest, the Four Corners region, and so on. Cultures all over the world spent a lot of time looking at the sky, trying to understand it, for a lot of reasons. Not the least of which was in terms of when to plant your crops, when to harvest. That's governed by the seasons, which in turn you can read from the stars. Or, just as likely, many deities of various cultures resided in the sky, and it was kind of nice to have an idea of what your deities were up to. They didn't sneak up behind you or something. And so there was a lot of observation of the sky for that reason as well. And so I'm going to mention a little bit of that along the way. I mentioned physics and nature, which is a bit of tomorrow's lecture, which is item number 4 on here. Winds, rivers, flight, and if you're brave enough, swimming in Lake Chelan. There are those who cannot float, and literally, physically, and we'll talk about why that is a little bit. Tour of the solar system. The 1980s, 70s and 80s, have produced some very spectacular pictures of our neighboring planets. You've seen most of those now, the most recent flybys. Voyager spacecraft just finished their grand tour a couple of years ago and produced just incredible pictures of the sky of the planets around us. I want to show you some of those and give you a flavor for what they are. But they also, very importantly to us, give us some information about what our Earth is like and can become, depending upon how we treat the world around us. Thinking particularly of the planet Venus, which I'll mention in a couple of days, just to give you a clue, it's the temperature at its surface is a balmy 750 degrees Fahrenheit. And not just because it's a little closer to the sun. So we're going to talk about some lessons from space. My particular interest in astronomy is understanding the nature of stars and how stars live and how they die. And so I'm going to talk about how a star is born in the astronomical sense on Wednesday, go through its life, and then, go through its life and then talk about the ends of stars as we understand them. One of the other things Mark mentioned a couple of times today was that we are all stardust. And that's true. And I want to show you what is meant by that phrase and how we come to believe that that is the case. The atoms in your bodies, with the exception of the hydrogen, were all made in the insides of previous generations of stars. Stars that have lived, gone through their lifetimes, and died before our own sun and solar system formed. So it gives us some sort of feel for where we are in the context of our own universe. Also need to mention a little bit about great telescopes, in particular Hubble. Hubble has been in the news a lot. I mentioned it is working. It's been up in orbit now about a year and has been producing some spectacular pictures and some very good science. And so we'll talk about that some. And then aspects of the immensity of our universe, the enormously large scales in which astronomers have to operate, and the very unusual characteristics that exist in the universe around us. So what I really want to do is give you sort of a tour of the universe during the course of this week and give you a feel for where astronomy has been, where it's going, and the nature of how science operates. On the next page of this, there's a suggested reading list in case you're looking for summer entertainment. There are some very good books in that list if you find that there are topics that you're curious about after you leave. There are a couple of magazines, several magazines actually, that are quite good. Sky and Telescope and Scientific American. Scientific American's a little bit higher level for those of you who have some interest. There's another magazine called Astronomy, which is also a very nice general background magazine. Then I've got a series of books on a variety of topics. Alice in the Space Telescope is kind of a cute little book I just read about a week or so ago that recently came out describing the nature of the space telescope as viewed from Alice in Wonderland and the Cheshire Cat and everybody else. Brief History of Time is a book that was on the number one bestseller list for weeks, actually months. It was written by Stephen Hawking, who is one of the great theoreticians in the nature of stars and gravity. We'll talk about him a little bit this week. Another wonderful book is Coming of Age in the Milky Way by Timothy Ferris. If you have an opportunity to read that one, it's a very interesting book, sort of an overview of our place in the Milky Way galaxy. There are several others in here as well, and I'll let you just sort of scan through that list. We're in a unique opportunity this month and next month, and I've included two pages at the back end, which are objects in the night sky for you to take a look at. There's a calendar for the month of June, day by day, pointing out some interesting things. One of those is a very rare triple conjunction of the planets Jupiter, Venus, and Mars that is going on right now. And for the next couple of weeks, you can watch those three planets do a dance in the sky. If we walk out tonight, just about sundown, just as the twilight is setting, and you're standing in the middle of the street and look up, you will see two very bright objects. The brightest will be Venus, the next brightest will be Jupiter, and as the darkness sets in between those will be the planet Mars. You can't miss them. And for those of you who are interested, I'll be happy to point those out perhaps this evening if you'd like. And you can watch them over the next couple of weeks, and they'll move past one another doing this interesting little dance and come as close as they do for the better part of a century during that period of time. So that's coming up the middle of this month. The middle of next month is something astronomers have been waiting for a long time. There is a total eclipse of the sun that's going to occur. Unfortunately, you're going to have to be in such terrible places as Hawaii, the south end of California, Mexico, in order to see the total eclipse. It's ironic, but the total eclipse of the sun, the path of that goes right over one of the largest telescopes in the world on top of Hawaii this year. And so we'll talk a little bit about what that is at Mauna Kea Observatory. The last page is again, a picture of the sky. It's a map, really, of what's up in the early evening hours in June. And you'll notice something right away. Astronomers don't know how to label north, south, east, and west on their graphs, on their pictures. That's because astronomers walk around all the time doing this. If you hold it up over your head, north, south, east, and west line up the way they're supposed to. So you have a chart of the sky that looks like this. If you walk around all night looking like that, you'll see which way north, south, east, and west are on the diagram there. And you can pick out your favorite constellations. Are there any questions about what we're going to be about this week?
Do you have an extra copy of the constructors?
I've got mine. There should be others.
There's a whole bunch of them.
There you go. I'll grab the others later. I don't
need
it now. That's fine.
What direction is Buckskin?
South, right? Buckskin is south. The valley runs east-west. Yeah. Okay. Oh. I want to show you a few slides before we get started too far here. Just to give you an idea of where we're at.
Yeah, the lights are right there. You can just hit them a little bit.
Astronomy, as I mentioned, is the oldest of the sciences. It started as far back as people were ever wondering about what the sky was like, looking up and seeing what was out there. Here is a typical picture of a field of stars. I happen to like this one for a couple of reasons. This is the star cluster known as the Pleiades. It's in the winter sky in the constellation known as Taurus the Bull. Taurus is a constellation which is right next to my favorite constellation in the sky, which is Orion. I mentioned in here yesterday, or I guess it was this morning, when the question came up, where is your favorite place? And I mentioned I'm an avid skier. Orion is usually referred to by most people as the hunter. To me, it is the skier, because when it appears in the sky, it's about ready to dump on Elgin Snowbird for the season. The constellations that are up during the year are related directly to the seasons. Orion is high in the sky in the middle of the winter. We are approaching midsummer now, and the constellation Sagittarius is going to become prominent, and the constellation Cygnus. That change in the constellations is related to the motion of our Earth around the sun. However, that's not how people understood the sky. In the first beginnings of trying to understand our universe, the Earth didn't go around the sun. The sun went around the Earth. I mean, that's obvious, isn't it? You stand here, you don't feel the Earth moving, unless it's one of Mark's earthquakes or something. You stand out and look up at night, and you see the stars going around you. That is the simplest picture of the universe. The sky goes around the Earth. This cluster, known as the Pleiades, some of you may also have seen a lot on the back of your cars. That is the corporate symbol for Subaru. On the back, you'll see a series of stars in a symbol for the Subaru cars. That's the Pleiades. It's sometimes called the Seven Sisters because when you go outside at night with the naked eye and look up, you can see six stars there. There's been a lot of discussion about where the seventh Pleiade went, and nobody is quite sure what the notion of the Seven Sisters ever was. But anyway, Taurus the Bull, in which this cluster of stars resides, is charging Orion, and Orion is doing battle with Taurus. His shield up, his club raised, and his sword hanging from his belt. Following behind him is his faithful dog, Canis Major, and the brightest star in Canis Major is Sirius. No, really. People looked up at the moon as well. Here's a picture of a full moon. This is obviously a telescopic picture of the moon. I'm going to mention Galileo a little bit later. Galileo got in a lot of trouble for looking at the moon and other objects with his new invented telescopes. Trying to understand the phases of the moon is one of the challenges of early astronomy. Here's a sequence of pictures of the moon moving through the shadow of the Earth. This is called a total eclipse of the moon. You can see a clear full moon here. Notice this curve. The moon marching into the Earth's shadow. And here, during a full eclipse of the moon looks blood red. That's because of the light bending around the Earth's atmosphere, exactly the same reason that sunsets are red. And then there's a curve going out, and so on. One of the misconceptions in the Middle Ages, or our current misconception of the Middle Ages, maybe, we're coming up on the 500th anniversary of Columbus sailing across to rediscover the New World. And one of the comments that you always learn is that everyone thought he was going to fall off the edge of the Earth. The Earth was flat. In that picture, there's proof that the Earth is round. Curved shadow. Curved shadow is cast by a round Earth. The ancient Greeks actually knew that. In fact, they had a measurement of how big the Earth was. It was some number of stadia. Unfortunately, we don't know how big the stadium was that they used, to calibrate their measurement. But nevertheless, Aristosthenes, I believe it was, measured the circumference of the earth by looking at shadows cast by sticks in the ground. People knew the earth was round, even as far back as before the birth of Christ. We're also going to look at the nature of total eclipse of the sun. In this case, the moon fits very nicely right in front of the sun most of the time, under the right geometrical conditions. Trying to understand that's tough. In fact, if you could understand at least some sense of when eclipses were going to occur, imagine the kind of power you would have had in ancient culture. If you don't listen to me, I'm going to make the light go out and make it come back again. When I was in graduate school, I used to spend a lot of time on Saturday mornings catching up on my sleep, doing my laundry, and the only thing on television were cartoons. One of those was Bugs Bunny, and there was a cartoon of Bugs Bunny getting burned at the stake in medieval Europe, and miraculously he pulled out an astronomical ephemeris out of his back bunny pocket and looked it up and discovered there was an eclipse about to happen. And he says, if you don't let me go, I'm going to make the sun go out. The moon passed in front of the sun, it got dark, everybody let him go, and he became king. Here's another picture of a total eclipse. Notice right in here the light running through the valleys on the edges of the moon. Those are called Bailey's beads. During a total eclipse of the sun's light can sneak through the little valleys around the edges of the moon, and you can still see some of that peek out. So that's indication that the moon is not a perfect sphere. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Meteors. A lot of people like to call them falling stars. They're not stars at all. It's a misnomer. They're chunks of rock falling from space for a couple of different reasons. They may be broken off pieces of other objects. They may be pieces left over when the solar system formed. They may be pieces left over from comets. We hear about meteor showers from time to time. Holden's a very nice place to see meteors. A meteor shower is an event, a series of events, a lot of meteors falling through, creating streaks in the sky over a very short period of time. Those are all produced by the debris of comets that are breaking up as they go around the solar system. And the Earth happens to go past the stuff left behind when the comets start falling apart. And when the Earth runs into all that junk, it falls into the atmosphere, flares up, heats up, burns up on its way in, and we get these streaks. Every once in a while, one leaves a pretty good-sized divot. This one's in Arizona, Beringer Crater. It measures the better part of a mile across, if I remember this numbers right. You can see roads here moving by. Some of you may have seen this or driven up to it. It's a common tourist attraction on the way by. There are objects that still strike the Earth. Some of them in the past have hit much more often. Mark mentioned this morning about life trying to form and constantly getting beaten back by meteor impacts in the early solar system, the early formation of our planet. They still do occur, not nearly as commonly as they used to, but sometimes with fairly dramatic effects.
Is there a meteor in that hole?
There was.
It was.
It got pulverized. It came in with such an energy that, for the most part, it just got vaporized, blown to pieces. Mm-hmm. And it just blew out around the edges. There are some mass density enhancements down in there, and there have been people who have looked at that. I don't really know all the details of exactly what they've been discovering in terms of changes below the surface.
What year did that happen?
This was some 50,000 years ago or some number like that, if I remember the date right.
How big was it?
I really don't remember what the numbers were. It doesn't have to be the whole size of this entire hole to do that kind of damage. Historically, the only case of anybody ever getting hit by one of these It's nothing that big. Some 20 years ago, there was some woman sitting in her house on the sofa, and one came through the ceiling. Hit her in the leg. She wasn't really hurt too badly. The house slowed it down. But in all of the impacts that have ever occurred, that's the only time anybody's ever even been heard of as getting hurt by one, so it's not anything to lose any sleep over by any means. Comets. Comets have an interesting history. The bearers of gloom and doom. People thought that they represented danger in our solar system, in fact, on our own planet. People thought that when a comet came by, that predicted the end of some dynasty, some ruler, or whatever. King Harold was known to have an astrologer nearby to tell him whether or not it was okay to go to war. And there was a comet that came by, recorded on the Bayeux Tapestry, and the prediction was that he was doomed. And sure enough, in a few years, he lost his throne or was killed. I forget exactly how it happened. But that happened. Whether it was coincidence or foretelling, who knows? We believe in science that those kinds of things are more coincidence than anything else, and they're pretty rare. We still have incidents where current rulers have astrologers hanging around. you may remember Nancy and Ronald Reagan and the local astrologer from California. Probably the hardest thing for astronomy to understand in its inception was the motion of the so-called wandering stars. We now call them today the planets. Their motions are very strange. They wander all over the place. To a degree, there is a path that cuts across the sky. These are constellations, the constellation of Aquarius, Pisces. There's a path that cuts across the sky, which astronomers call the ecliptic. The sun, the moon, and the planets all follow very close along that path across the sky. You don't ever find Jupiter up by the North Star Polaris. It's always along some band called the ecliptic. And these wandering stars would do very odd things. They would march along the fixed stars. And you can see this was in 1988, the path of Mars, located on June 1st, July 1st, and then it sort of decides it was going the wrong way for a while. It turns around, goes backwards, that's called a retrograde loop, and then it finally remembers which way it was supposed to go, turns around and heads back off again. This problem of trying to understand the motion of the planets was the research problem in astronomy for nearly 2,000 years. Just trying to understand that motion. Okay, let me turn off the slides for just a second. And mention a couple of key players in ancient Greek astronomy. One of those was Plato. Plato started off our study of the universe on what we would consider today to be the wrong foot. He made some assumptions about how the universe works. And I've already mentioned one of those. The Earth doesn't move. The Earth sits here and everything goes around it. That was one of Plato's assumptions. The Earth is the center of the universe. That assumption seemed obvious. There was no reason to assume otherwise at that point. There was no observational evidence to suggest that the Earth goes around the sun. Why make life complicated? Pick the easiest picture. That's what Plato did. There were also a couple of other assumptions that were made. One is that basically they follow along the philosophy that there's the Earth down here, and then there were the perfect heavens, the perfect skies above us. That notion of perfection led Plato to the idea that there not only was the earth the center, but that the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, all went around the earth, right, the earth the center, the sun, moon, planets, all went around the earth in perfect circles. That was Plato's concept of what it meant to be a perfect universe. The most perfect kind of motion in a perfect universe were circles. So therefore, everything goes around in circles. Moreover, they go around in circles at constant speeds. They don't hurry up and slow down. They don't speed up, but rather they go at the same speed all the time, unchanging. We call that a geocentric universe with uniform and circular motion. Uniform meaning constant speed and circular motion. That set of assumptions were the paradigm, the fixed theory of the day. This paradigm became so rooted in how we viewed the universe that it became religious doctrine by the Middle Ages. It became the way the universe was. Now, Plato really made life difficult for a lot of people. Plato was a pretty well-known guy. You listened to him. But moreover, it made sense, these set of assumptions. So now, what are we going to do about that? Well, Plato suggested to a student of his, Eudoxus, to use this set of ideas to try to understand the motion of the planets, the wandering stars and those retrograde loops, the changing back and forth. Eudoxus, being a pretty clever guy, said, okay, the stars look like they're on a sphere, a big ball in the sky. Everywhere you look, you see this big sphere out there at a large distance from us, and all the stars are fixed on it. And that sphere is slowly spinning around us. That works very well for the stars. Doesn't work quite so well for the sun. The sun keeps moving. Slowly, but at least it keeps going in the same direction all the time. And so what Eudoxus did was build another sphere for the sun. And he attached that one to the sphere for the stars. Can people see this with the dim light if I draw over here?
In black.
Okay, here we go. Here's Eudoxus' picture of the universe. There's a sphere for the stars with the earth sitting here in the middle. So there was this mysterious axis, this pivot point around which the sphere moved. And so the sphere, and if I draw in Ursa Major, the Big Dipper here, pointing off toward the North Star, the whole thing is spinning like this, carrying all the stars with it. On top of that was another sphere. Good thing we got more than one black pen here. This sphere carried the sun on it with another axis. So the sun might be at some point here. And as that inner sphere would spin one way, they'd get the sun to go another way at a different speed, still on a sphere, and get it to move along a path. Here at the middle of the earth, you didn't see the spheres themselves, but you saw what was stuck on them. They might have been clear crystalline spheres, something nice and exotic, and having everything move along them. Well, then you needed another few for the moon, because it was a much more complicated motion. So it needed several to explain the moon. You needed a lot more to explain all the planets that were wandering around back and forth, couldn't make up their mind which way they wanted to go. By the time they were all done, they had 56 of these spheres, all going every which way, trying to explain what was going on. Eudoxus was a student of Plato's. I guess he got his equivalent of the PhD. He kept on going. It was fine after that. Certainly a strange concept. It held sway for 200 years. That's not bad for a theory. 200 years. Until a guy by the name of Hipparchus tried a new picture. Hipparchus said, well, let's get rid of spheres and let's use circles. We have to obey Plato's idea of uniform and circular motion. So he created a circle with the earth at the center. On that circle, he put another circle. This circle carried the planet. That planet would go around on the little circle, while the little circle went around on the big circle. Have you all seen a spirograph, that toy that makes all these curly Q things? That's exactly what this is. It's a spirograph. Because as this thing goes around like this, sometimes it's on the inside of this big circle. Sometimes it's on the outside. And as it goes around, it does this little number. That little turn right there was the retrograde loop. By making the little circle go faster or slower relative to the big circle, Hipparchus could do a pretty good job of explaining the motions of the planets. He even got it right to say that when they go backwards, they're brightest. And that's exactly what happens, because at this point, they're closest to the Earth. So they're brightest at that time. That was 100 BC. He was doing other things at the time, too. He was a kind of a busy guy. He described a little bit about the mathematics of trigonometry, which a lot of my students cringe at as soon as that is mentioned. He also made the first catalog of the stars, about 700 stars. He wrote down their positions and their brightnesses, and he made up what is known as the magnitude brightness scale, which all my introductory astronomy students detest, because it works backwards. The brightest star in the sky was number one. The dimmest star was number six. Why he picked six, we don't know. But in any case, that was the way it worked. So the bigger the number, the dimmer it was. And my students never liked that. 200 years after that, Claudius Ptolemy beefed up the picture. Because over another 200 years, we had all sorts of new data, new observations to explain. And the more information you get, the tougher it is to explain what the world is like. Well, what Ptolemy did was cheat. He moved the Earth away from the center, put it over here. He put another point over here and had this small circle go around the other point at a constant so-called speed. Actually, we call that an angular speed. When I was growing up in Minnesota, I started playing a lot of hockey. Now, to do justice right, a lot of other people played a lot of hockey, and I sat in the middle as they went around me and sort of ran around the ice on my ankles. Well, one of the games we would play when we got bored of playing hockey was crack the whip. People familiar with that game? We make a big long line of people. Yes. And little kids are great at this game. You get about 50 of them together. After they've all gone into the corner to chase the puck and keep hitting each other in the shins, after a while they get bored and play the crack the whip. Somebody in the middle would just stand there. You'd link hands one after the other and go around the ice like this. While it's a piece of cake for the guy in the middle, he's doing this. The poor kid on the outside is just flying around the corner, bouncing off the boards, getting all bruised up, but they all go around the circle in the same amount of time. But the one on the outside goes fastest. That's exactly what Ptolemy managed to do, because when the planet gets over here, it's got to go faster because it's further away from the point it was going around. And so that took care of sort of cheating his way around the idea of everything moving at the same speed. He sort of twisted the rules a bit. Whether Plato was a little upset with him at the time is a different question. You can argue for yourself whether it was uniform and circular motion anymore. But the notion was that this picture that was proposed now 450 years earlier was being tough to fit into what was really being seen. For the next about 1,400 years, Ptolemy's picture, and his name, in case you're curious, is spelled this way. For the next 1,400 years, that picture was the way the universe was. For 1,400 more years, still obeying this idea of uniform and circular motion. That's a tough pattern to break yourself out of. It was the way of looking at the universe. Everything that was considered with this set of assumptions and that picture of the universe as implicit. The heavens out there, the earth here, what was out there is perfect. What is in here may not be, but everything was following uniform and circular motion. A contemporary of Columbus and Luther, a guy by the name of Copernicus. And why don't we take about a 5-minute break, and then I'm going to finish this story up a little bit, and talk about what Copernicus and the people following him did to get us a feel for what our world is really like today. The reason I wanted to go through that whole litany about what the ancient Greeks thought was to sort of set up a picture of how the how we as scientists try to understand the world around us and what sorts of inherent assumptions underlie that. When I had this list of Plato's assumptions up here that were indicated there, the Earth is the center of the universe, planets go around at a constant speeds, at perfect circles, those were a set of what today seem to be kind of silly assumptions. We know better than that. Every theory that is ever proposed has something like this at its center. There are a series of assumptions in everything, in every scientific theory. That's why it's a theory. Theories can never be proven. They can only be disproven. Scientists sit around all their lives looking for holes in theories or trying to take a theory and build on it. But underlying it are a series of assumptions. The card deck was about to crumble under Plato's idea, under the advent of a new way of looking at the world around us, not just in the world of astronomy. But it was an awakening of intellectual thought. The time of Columbus, 1492. We're coming up on the 500th anniversary next year. By the way, to commemorate that, there's a race to Mars going on, driven by the solar wind. People are going to build giant sails in space and try to sail across the solar system to Mars. You can actually do that. Getting blown around by the wind coming off of the sun and the light coming off of the sun. It can push giant sails, and so they're going to be a big race. It's an unmanned race. But nevertheless, they're going to build these things and go flying across and see who wins. At the same time, there were the Renaissance, the new world, new way to look at the world. One of the players in the game was Copernicus. By the time we got to about 1500, there were getting to be so many complicated pieces to the picture. This picture of Ptolemy and his circles and loops and everything, by the time they got that far, in order to understand everything that was happening, there were now 256 circles sitting on top of circles, all going around in some weird mesh, trying to understand how the world worked, how the universe moved. Copernicus finally said there's got to be an easier way. Can't be that complicated. Copernicus suggested one thing. Put the sun at the center. In doing that, he immediately ended up with some real nice results. He could now put the sun at the center, put all the planets around the sun, the planet Mercury, Venus, the Earth. Now there's a shocker. The Earth is a planet. It's not the center of the universe, it's a planet. Just like everything else that we're looking at. And what's worse, it's not the first one. It's not even the last one. It's somewhere in the middle. Mars. And then Jupiter and Saturn. Those were the ones that were known at the time. That was a shock. To suggest that to a world that had just spent almost 2,000 years since Plato, assuming that the Earth is the center of the universe, now put the Sun at the center and the Earth as a mere planet going around it. That assumption radically changed our view of what we were about in the universe, because now there was another center. It naturally explained a lot of things. It explained the backward loops, retrograde motion as it's called, very naturally. Essentially a fast car overtaking a slow one. The inner planets go fast, the outer planets go slow, the Earth is moving along. It keeps changing its position every time you look at everything else, and so it's a catch-up game. And it just matters which way you look. And you see this changing pattern, and you see the planets go backwards for a while. So that is a natural outcome of that picture. The seasons of the year became a natural outcome of that picture because of the tilt of the Earth that Copernicus was now able to simply include. The Earth is sort of leaned over by 23.5 degrees. That makes the Sun move higher in the summer and lower in the sky in the winter because the Earth is leaning over on its side. And I'll show you a picture of that in just a second. It explained the ordering of the planets and so on. But it was a dangerous proposal. Dangerous enough that there were those who were honestly afraid for Copernicus for its publication. When the book was published, in the preface, there was a short introduction put in by a friend of his. And the introduction said, Nikolai doesn't believe this. It's just a great way to explain the motions of the planets. The story goes, and we don't know for sure if it's true, that he saw the first published copy of it the day he died, or at least on his deathbed, and never saw its complete repercussions. The Catholic Church banned it. It became on the black list of books after a while, the forbidden list of books. And it became an uphill struggle to see what would happen. But there were those who did believe the idea. One of those was a guy by the name of Tycho Brahe. If I could just have a few more slides here for a minute. Here's a picture, and let me just run through these very quickly. This is an Earth-centered picture of our universe, with the Sun still in this picture going around the Earth. It goes from, you can see that there's a tilt here. This sort of yellowish, kind of obnoxious looking color is the path that the Sun, according to one picture, would follow around the Earth. And when it's up here in the summer solstice, which we're only about 3 weeks away from, the Sun will be as high in the sky as it ever gets, the longest day of the year. When it's way down here at winter solstice, those who hang around here all year tell me that it gets kind of long after a while. And they celebrate when the Sun comes up over Buckskin sometime in the middle of the spring, when it finally gets high enough in the sky that they can see it again. That change is, on this picture, a result of how the Sun goes around the Earth. Let me just, this was a cathedral in London, Wells Cathedral. And when the cathedral was built, it was a geocentric universe. There's a clock on the wall that shows an Earth-centered universe. There's a close-up of the sun. Here we have Copernicus' picture of the sun, the earth, and the planet Mars. This just shows you how easily it is to talk about this motion of the retrograde loop, the planets going backwards. Here's the earth and Mars one day. Here's the earth and Mars a little later, and so on. And so you can see that they're moving with respect to each other, and the line is the path that you would have to look at from the Earth to see Mars, and then where it lies against the star field back here. And so one day you look here against the star field, then you look there, then you look there, and then you look there, and there's the backward loop right there. So this, it's very easy to explain the motion that way on the star field. Every time I mention that term, star field, I've got a colleague that I work with from time to time when I go down to New Mexico to do some research. He's an astronomer. His name's Sumner Starfield. Sumner had no choice as to what profession he was going into.
Did you say that was in Copernicus' book?
Yep, the equivalent of that picture. Yeah, exactly. Here's how the seasons really work. Here's the 23.5 degree tilt. This is the Earth rotates around this little axis, almost like there's a line right through the Earth, and it just spins on that like a ball. But it's tilted with respect to straight up and down around the sun. Depending on which way it's tilted is the seasons of the year, where you are on the orbit. Here's the first day of summer in the northern hemisphere because that side is sort of tilted over toward the sun. In the winter, it's tilted away from the sun, way over on the other side. By the way, the Earth is furthest from the sun about July 4th. That's not why we're hot in the northern hemisphere. We're hot in the northern hemisphere because we're tilted over toward the sun, not because we're close to it. We are actually further away at the time. Oh, let me bypass that. If people are interested later, I can describe to you how the phases of the moon work. Here is the moon going around the Earth. That's also on Copernicus's picture, except that it's tilted a little bit. Sometimes it's below the blue path, which is the plane of the Earth's orbit. Sometimes it's above it. When it's right along that line, there's an intersection, and that intersection is what produces eclipses. When the moon happens to be right in line with the Earth and the Sun, you can get an eclipse. And here are pictures of that. The new moon is coming up in July 11th. That's when you don't see the bright side, you see the dark side. The bright side is on the other side. And it gets between us and the sun. And when it does, it can block the sun out at the right time, if it happens to be along these so-called lines of nodes. It has to be in just the right place in its orbit for that to happen. Here's Tycho. I mentioned Copernicus was followed by Tycho Brahe. Tycho was the world's greatest naked-eye astronomer. This was still before the invention of telescopes. This is a wood carving of Tycho at work. And what he's showing is that he is pointing up. You don't see it on this entire picture, but he's pointing up through a hole in his wall to the stars. Tycho Brahe had a whole castle built for him by the King of Denmark on the island of Aveen. The whole castle was built as an observatory. And Tycho spent laborious nights looking through giant quadrants like this, marked out in degrees, to line up the stars as carefully as he could. He discovered that comets were very far from the Earth. They were not actually in the Earth's atmosphere. That relieved a lot of people. He also saw a star blow up called a supernova. That's called Tycho's supernova. He was also a party animal. He loved to party. He'd throw great late-night parties. While he was doing that, a guy by the name of Kepler came to work for him. Johannes Kepler. Kepler worked for him for many years, because he knew Tycho had all this great data and Kepler wanted his hands on it. Well, one day, Tycho was throwing one of his wild parties. Oh, by the way, he once got in a duel. He accidentally cut his nose off. And so you see some portrait, he had a brass nose made after that for parties. And sometimes you see him with or without his nose. Kepler was with him one day when he apparently partied too hard and didn't survive the night, and somehow Kepler got his data. We don't quite know how that all worked, but Johannes Kepler recovered Tycho Brahe's data and spent the next 19 years of his life without a calculator, without even a slide rule, trying to make the numbers work. And when he did, he found out that Copernicus was only half right. What he discovered, let me hold off on this picture for just a second. What he discovered was that the planets go around the sun, all right, but they go around the sun in something called an ellipse. It's sort of a squashed circle, kind of like the shape of a football, but it's awfully close to being an ellipse. These are known as Kepler's laws. It goes around an ellipse, and it goes around in a certain way, certain changing speeds, and the time it takes for it to go around once is related to how far away it is from the sun. What he did was find a mathematical way of describing the motions of the planets. Copernicus still wanted to assume circles. Copernicus needed circles. He wasn't even willing to admit that there weren't circles. So he made one big step, but he didn't make the whole step. If I could add, let's see, the slides again. A contemporary of Kepler in the early 1600s, this guy by the name of Galileo. Galileo was the first person to use a telescope to look at the sky. He didn't invent it. He just read about it one night and figured out how to make it. It had been invented a year earlier. He picked up an article, looked at it, and went home and built one. Used it to look at the sky and discovered a lot of things. He discovered, in this particular excerpt, four moons around Jupiter. We now call those the Galilean moons. There's a telescopic picture of them. I'll show you those up close and personal in a couple of days. They're fantastic images, very amazing objects. Some of you have seen, I'm sure, some pictures of them. They're just incredible objects to look at. He discovered those four moons. Well, that was still a no-no in the day, because that indicated that the Earth was definitely not the only center, if it was a center at all, of the universe. There was one other one out there at least, and you could see it. He looked at the planet Venus and found out it had phases, just like the moon does. He looked at the moon and saw it had mountains and craters. It certainly wasn't perfect. He looked at the Milky Way, and it wasn't just a band of light. It was a huge number of stars, individual stars. If the universe was put out there just for us to look at, why did you need a telescope to see that? Why did you need a telescope to see the individual stars? And then he looked at the sun. He looked at the sun and found out it was certainly not a perfect sphere. Of all the things in the universe, the doctrine indicated ought to be a perfect sphere, it should have been the sun. And what he saw was it had spots on it. Sunspots. He even mapped out where they were. Well, he got all excited about that and wanted to tell the world. He was not a political person. He first tried to do that and let people look through his telescope. Members of the prominent in the church, in fact, the Pope was a friend of his, for a while anyway. He let them look through the telescope, and they rejected it out of hand as being the work of the devil. And what they saw at the other end wasn't really true. He then tried to write a book. Actually, it was a play. It was a three-character play called A Dialogue of Two Chief World Systems. In it, there were three characters. Segreto, Simplicio, and I forgot the name of the third guy. Simplicio was the person who was trying to defend the old view of the world, not a subtle naming convention for his character, the simpleton. And then all the way through, there was a debate, and the debate kept going down on the side of the person who believed in the Copernican sun-centered model of the universe. All of that work won him house arrest for the rest of his life. He was, in fact, condemned by the Catholic Church, and during that period of time, he was forced to recant his views in writing, otherwise he was going to be put into torture, at least that's the way the story goes. And it was recently decided, I think in 1980, right around 1985 or 4, somewhere in that neighborhood, that that was certainly a mistake of the church in that day. And the condemnation was withdrawn. That set up the stage for another individual. He was born the year of Galileo's death. I said I had to put two equations. There's one of them. It's one of the two most famous equations in all of physics. That's Isaac Newton. F equals ma. You may have heard of that equation. It says force equals mass times acceleration. That's all I'm going to worry about it. But I just wanted to write it down. Newton was born on Christmas Day, 1642. He grew up in rural England, went to Cambridge University for school. Then the plague hit. They closed Cambridge for a year and a half because of the plague. He went back home. He was 23, 24 at the time. He didn't have anything else to do with his long summer vacation, so he sat under a tree, at least the story goes. And during that time, an apple fell on his head. He later, he would never admit one way or the other whether that story was true or not, whether an apple really did fall on his head. But his conclusion was that the apple fell for exactly the same reason that the moon goes around the earth, gravity. There was this thing called gravity that pulls everything. And it's always pulling it. It's pulling the moon right now. The moon is trying to fall to the earth, but it's actually going in a circle because of that. Otherwise, it would just go flying off into space. So it's got to be pulled back. He proposed that. He invented differential calculus. He worked on a theory of light. He wrote down three laws of motion. And he did all of it when he was 24 years old for that period of time when Cambridge University was closed. Years later, he still hadn't published anything. A friend of his by the name of Edmund Halley, of Halley Comet fame, came up to him and said, "You know, I've been looking at this thing that keeps coming back every 76 years, or at least it seems to be the same thing. Do you know anything about how that works?" He says, "Well, yeah, I think I derived it about 25 years ago, but I got to go look at my notes." He couldn't find his notes, so he just re-derived it that night, gave it to Halley. Halley said, "Haven't you ever written this down, published this?" He says, "No." Well, Halley funded it. He published a book called The Principia. The Principia is probably the most amazing book that's ever been written. In it is calculus, is laws of motion, is gravity, all under one piece. That is really our start to understanding the world around us now. There was a test that was made once, proposed a problem in physics, that the person who proposed it didn't like Newton very much and was trying to stump him. And the proposal had to do with describing the shape of how a rope hangs. And the problem was proposed to the international community as sort of a game. Try to explain this. And they assumed it would take like a year to derive the equations that would explain this. It was handed to Newton at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The next morning, he had the solution. Turned it back in. The author, and who published it anonymously, when it was published, the editor put in, by the claw, the lion is revealed. There was only one person who could have done that. It was Isaac Newton. He also wrote down, talked about a theory of light that didn't be quite as supportive, didn't get quite as far, but nevertheless, it still made some important contributions. During the later part of his life, for a long period of time, he was kind of unproductive. And there's been a lot of debate about what happened. There was thought that he might have had a nervous breakdown. There was also, most recently, discussion that actually he may have accidentally poisoned himself for a period of time, lead and mercury poisoning. Alchemy was a big game in those days, which is trying to do things like turn one metal into another kind. And one of the tests that was done was to bite on it, chew a little piece and see what it tasted like and see if you noticed any change. Well, things they were working on were heavily filled with lead and mercury. In any case, when he died, he did come recover and make some other contributions. He saved the monetary system of England, for one. When he was when he died, he was buried in Westminster Abbey. He had also been previously knighted. He had been made head of the Royal Society for life. Nobody else had the opportunity to compete with him. One last person I'd like to mention in passing. Is that funny looking guy? Albert Einstein. From the mid-1600s, late 1600s until 1905, Newton and his ideas of how the universe worked were the standard picture of the day. Some little problems start cropping up. In 1905, there was another piece of work that was probably as amazing as the work of Newton when he was 24. At the age of 26, Albert Einstein wrote four papers, all in the same research journal, all within the span of a few pages, any one of which would have won him the Nobel Prize. Some people call it the miracle year. In it were things that talk about what we now call something known as a special theory of relativity, that time and space are really versions of the same thing. And in it is his most famous equation, E equals mc squared. Energy is equal to mass times this constant c, again multiplied by itself, c squared. That c is the speed. It says that energy and matter are two forms of exactly the same thing. That you can turn one into the other. You can turn matter into energy. You can turn energy into matter. You can make mass or destroy it, and it gives you energy. That changed the way we saw the world from there on. Those two people, Newton and Einstein, set the stage for the rest of our understanding of what the universe is like and what the stars, how the stars work, how they move, what the planets are like. And so for the rest of the week, I want to talk about what those people did for us. Tomorrow, I'm going to spend some time talking about sound and light and how that is a result of what Newton did and what others did. And then I want to talk about the planets and the stars and galaxies. Show you a lot of photographs of what the universe looks like now and how it's going to behave. And some questions that are raised, probably as many questions as there are answers, maybe even more. But that's what makes this game fun, is to look for the answers instead of just have all of the answers already determined. I want to make sure that there are lots of opportunities for asking questions. So if I start rambling on this week, don't hesitate to flag me down, put the brakes on or something. But at this point, I think we're zeroing in on the dinner bell. And so let me stop there, and I'll be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Do you have any predictions on how long Mr. Einstein's relativity will last as a current paradigm?
Good question. We got into a habit before the turn of this century thinking we had all the answers. Boy, was that dangerous. Because then came along Einstein and a few other people and pulled the rug out from under everybody. We don't know. Up to this point, there have been no indications that there are problems. But, as I mentioned before, it's just a theory. I hate to use the word just a theory, because it makes predictions. But nevertheless, it's a theory that suggests certain kinds of things. And then you go out and test for those. But up to this point, we haven't seen any indication that there's any problem, at least so far. Einstein himself said that it probably will sooner or later be overthrown. Every theory usually is.